You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
I know that you were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
You know what's wrong with you?
What?
Nothing.
Hey, would you mind putting that gun away? My wife doesn't care, but I'm a very timid fellow.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it.
I've got a good mind to join a club and beat you over the head with it.
No, don't do that. If you shoot him, you just make him mad.
I can no longer sit back and allow the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Girls, come on. Leave the saving of the world to the men? I don't think so.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. Many thanks to Neil and Julie for the past 2 hours. But now at 12 p.m, it's time for Bums on Seats. And this is not your average common or garden Bums on Seats. Rather, welcome to the first of our two Saturday specials covering the 34th Cambridge Film Festival. Over the next hour, we'll review some of the films that have already screened and preview a couple of the films coming up over the next few days. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me on the show this morning are Sarah Dillon.
Hello.
Ed Elliott.
Hello.
And Mark Livicic.
Good afternoon.
As befits a programme documenting a world cinema film festival, we'll be jetting around the world over the next hour, taking in the south of France with Woody Allen's Magic in the Moonlight, threading our way through both fairytale kingdoms and the flyover states in teen drama I Believe in Unicorns, Corns rather, keeping ourselves in the shadows with terrorist drama Night Moves and dancing about Paris and Attila Marvel, the live-action debut from brilliant animator Sylvain Chomet. Plus, we talked to director Gil Kaufman at the festival to screen his Tel Aviv-set drama The White Room, and we'll be dashing here, there and everywhere as we get the lowdown on the 30 or so miniature masterpieces screening as part of the festival's short fusion season. But first, we're holding hands in the dark.
I'm getting a mental impression. Are you from the Orient? Far East?
Considering you are Wailing Sue, that's pretty damn impressive.
You are a very clever little humbug.
I think you'll trick me into showing you how I deceive people.
Stanley doesn't believe in spiritualists. He thinks you're all scoundrels.
She's quite likable, even if she is a fraud.
I understand you're holding a seance tonight.
The planets are in alignment.
Now I will summon the unseen world.
Give us a sign.
The more I watch her, the more I'm stumped.
Could she be real?
I'm beginning to question my own common sense.
You've always been so certain about the world, and I've always tried to teach you that we don't know.
I'm overwhelmed, Sophie. I never dreamed you could look this beautiful.
I believe that the dull reality of life is all there is, but you are proof that there's more mystery, more magic.
It would not quite be the Cambridge Film Festival without the premiere of the latest Woody Allen. Of course, it's always a gamble. Will the festival play host to a tired and formulaic Woody Allen, or one of the marvellous Woody Allen enjoys a sparkling return to form? Last year with Blue Jasmine, it was the latter, but advance word on his follow-up, Magic in the Moonlight, hasn't been as promising. Woody Allen, it's his 44th feature film, and it finds him back with a comedy and back in the 1920s, a carefree jazz hands decade he seems to adore. The film opens with the stage act of the great A. Ling Su, a popular Chinese magician who turns out to be a grumpy Englishman by the name of Stanley. Played by Colin Firth, Stanley is a genius conjurer who has grown disillusioned with his act. Half-heartedly looking for distraction, he accepts an offer to summer in the Côte d'Azur, an offer extended by rich friends in the hope he'll help untangle their son from the unwanted attentions of a young American woman by the name of Sophie. Played by Emma Stone, Sophie claims to be a clairvoyant, a supernatural boast that the rational Stanley expects to easily debunk. But this is the French Riviera at the height of the summer season, and before long, a very different kind of magic is in the air. Mark, Woody Allen nowadays seems at his best when trying something new, Blue Jasmine last year. I know you didn't like it, but in general the consensus was that worked, and Vicky Cristina Barcelona a few years before that. Magic in the Moonlight, on the other hand, is based on a 30-year-old script, which he sort of dusted off and sprinkled some fairy dust over. How did you find it, the sparkling return to form, or has he just laboured over this old material?
I think for me it's very much middle-tier Woody Allen. It's not
his worst, but it's by a long, long way from his best. I think there's a couple of bright notes. Colin Firth is entertaining in his curmudgeonly mode. He's probably given short service by the script at various points, but he does what he can with the material. The other highlight of his acting was Eileen Atkins as the aunt who's he regularly turns up to for advice. I think, in terms of the principle, it feels like he's trying to have his cake and eat it. In terms of recent films, we talked about Midnight in Paris, which was probably his most recent success for my view, and that, to me, was an exploration of something truly magical. Here, he's trying to deconstruct magic, and actually, it feels like he's trying to take all viewpoints and argue for them across the course of his career. Ultimately, this is a very cynical film at its heart, and that doesn't mesh with the love story it's trying to set out.
But isn't that the clash that Woody Allen's always had, that he's produced some of the best romantic comedies of that exist within cinema, but yes. He's always been a cynic.
But he has been a cynic, but there's a cynical realism about a lot of his great love stories, whereas actually the love story here is very mawkish and sentimental and very traditional, which doesn't then gel with the other more traditional Woody Allen-style elements. Also, those are not particularly thought through. You can't just have a discussion about the differences between science and religion and faith, chuck in a few Nietzsche references and hope that's enough. It's not.
Ed, you liked Blue Jasmine. This is one of your films of the year, I believe. You helped push it into
the top ones, yeah.
this is a different beast altogether. But he's still working on, as Mark said, unsuccessfully, apparently, but he's still working on his usual themes. Is there, and that always seems to draw a complaint, but is there actually anything wrong with that? Or is it just the fact he doesn't find new nuances, new aspects to these themes?
It's a difficult one because, I mean, he is working with the same themes, but I think the problem for me is that he seems to have, again, I have to agree with Mark, he seems to have lost that individual sort of viewpoint, that individual look on those themes. I mean, other than the sort of the odd line, it feels a bit like Magic in the Moonlight could have been directed by almost anyone. There isn't a huge amount there that's particularly distinctive. And actually, the script and the dialogue is pretty... it's pretty average in comparison to a lot of his more recent stuff. I felt that actually the real problem I had, it's strange that you picked out Colin Firth as one of the highlights. I actually think Colin Firth was really miscast in this role, particularly for the mean stuff at the beginning. You know, it's a long time since he's been Mr. Darcy on BBC and he could pull off that sort of glare and it sort of works. On this, you kind of look at him and he's saying these horrible lines. You think, oh, you know, you're actually kind of lovable. And then the problem is then when he turns out, so, you know, he switches halfway through to be the lovable, wide-eyed believer, it kind of then the script lets him down and it seems like it's all too mawkish, too annoying, too imbecilic. So in the end, you're kind of left with these two points of view, neither of which work out, leaving the kind of romance at the end feeling very hollow, because at the end he has to decide between which of these two personalities he wants to be. And you kind of, as the audience member, you kind of end up thinking, well, actually, I don't really want you to be either. You're kind of a bit annoying as both, so let's just leave it here, you know. So that for me was the key problem with the film, really, as well as sort of I think a deficiency of laughs.
I like that.
Yeah. it wasn't funny. I mean, I think you're being am I Mike?
Yes,
here?
Yes, you're fine.
I think you're being incredibly generous to it. It's a terrible film. I think it was made by anybody other than Woody Allen, people would probably have walked out. And I'm playing devil's advocate here a little bit, but the person sitting next to me did fall asleep during it. It wasn't funny. It wasn't well acted. It wasn't well scripted. It was beautiful, and the women were wearing very nice shoes, so costume design did very well. But overall, it was dull and dreary.
This is difficult because I've not seen it, so you're not convincing me to go see it. And I like Woody Allen, and I liked Blue Jasmine, and I find even his most frivolous of comedies, there's usually something else going on. And I was intrigued by the fact that Colin's first character is asked to and accepts an unrational world. That to me feels like a development. Where all previous Woody Allen protagonists find a joy maybe in the arts, such as Woody Allen watching the Marx Brothers film in Hannah and Her Sisters, but otherwise, actually having Colin Firth embrace the magical seems like a development.
I was just going to say that it seems like it's going down an interesting Woody Allen path when he accepts it, but then it completely cops out at the end, in my point of view. There's a particular point where a marriage proposal is thrown out and initially rejected, where it could very easily go down a very interesting route and could be suddenly very interesting and skeptical and, you know, completely change the film. And instead it sort of completely cops out and goes down what for me was a horribly kind of stodgy and happy and yucky kind of ending that, again, just didn't feel like Woody Allen to me.
Because it was Jane Austen. I mean, he rehashed Tennessee Williams' A Streetcar Named Desire last year for Blue Jasmine. This time he's gone back to Pride and Prejudice. It's no surprise, I don't think, that we have Colin Firth, who played Darcy in the BBC version, reappearing in that role. I think Toby, what you're finding difficult is that on paper it sounds like an interesting film. You've got magicians, you've got the combination of magical theatre and cinema, which have very interesting combined roots in terms of whether the audience is meant to believe or not believe what they're seeing. That links with one of the whole themes of the film, which is, what do we believe? Do we believe what we see, or is there something beyond what we can see? These are all really fantastic and interesting and important questions, but there's no substance to the way in which they're investigated. I mean, Woody Allen's films rest on being well written. He's a filmmaker who uses words, not images, to tell his stories. That's fine if the script's good, but if the script's not good and you haven't got the visual element of storytelling, which is so crucial to cinema, the film fails. And that's why it doesn't work for me, because in the end Woody Allen is not writing a script that's interesting.
I don't think his films have relied on words for quite a long time. I think his films rely on performances, which is why they're usually, as with Cate Blanchett, deservedly winning an Oscar for a fairly underwritten role. Though, I say that, but Sally Hawkins' character is very good in Blue Jasmine. That's a very good, rounded supporting character.
Well, I think that's probably the key difference for me. We sort of mentioned my dislike of Blue Jasmine. It wasn't. My dislike was of Cate Blanchett's performance in Blue Jasmine. I liked a fair amount of the rest of the film, in particular the fact of Sally Hawkins' performance, but also a lot of the other performances, even the likes of Bobby Cannavale, who had smaller roles. They were all well-built, well-constructed characters in Blue Jasmine. My one objection was with the way that Cate Blanchett's character was portrayed in her performance. Ultimately, there's about half a character in Magic in the Moonlight. I would disagree slightly with the Mr. Darcy comparison. I think he's almost nearer Mark Darcy than Mr. Darcy. I think Mr. Darcy himself is aloof but generally honourable, whereas the character Colin Firth here is almost dishonourable because he's so regularly, completely dismissive of everyone else's views and doesn't sort of aim for that integrity. Ultimately, the film sides with him in the end, which I think is probably its biggest misstep.
But not a surprise.
No, but
he doesn't really, looking at his body of work, have a history of writing convincing or even reasonable female characters. As in Blue Jasmine, but it's Blanche DuBois, has been said. Is this another case of the female characters falling? As Midnight in Paris, which is a wonderful, wonderful film in many regards, but again, the women are either shrews or muses. And is that the case here with
yes,
his two-dimensional yes. grasp
Sophie,
of people?
Sophie, who is supposed to be the clairvoyant, supposed to be the medium. I mean, all her kind of false theatrics are evidently false from the beginning. It's ham acting. And everyone regularly refers to her as a pretty little thing or a kind of... it's always about her looks.
But they would have done it at the time, to be fair.
And that's fine, but if you're going to have a substantial character, there has to be some pushback to that. Mm. And there isn't. There's no depth to that characterisation. So actually you come away thinking, she is just a pretty little thing. There's nothing else there.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's completely that clear, and it might just... I really like Emma Stone. I think she's a terrific actress, and I can't quite work out whether she just brought something more to that role than that's written there. But I think
that's usually the case. Yeah, with
I mean, there are some. She does have some clever lines. I think there are other female characters in the film. I'm thinking, in particular, his aunt, who do have some good lines, who are funny, who aren't just that sort of shrew. What was the other
muse?
One? Muse. Well, she's a little bit of a muse, I guess. But I think that it's not quite so clear-cut as in other films that he's made where the female characters are all either sound like men or, you know, completely boring.
Well, they're just drawn from literature. Yeah. He's got to the stage now because he's so learned that his films don't breathe any oxygen. Mm. And I don't mind that. There are many revered French directors that the films don't seem to exist in the real world, and we'll discuss one later, though perhaps that's unfair. But it's... I think it's a bit of a problem with Woody Allen, because he seems to be saying so much, but he doesn't have real characters as his mouthpieces.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that the kind of the gender politics of this film are the difficulty. I say there are a lot of other problems we have to deal with first before getting around to that. But
well, it was the only thing I had in my notes. I hadn't seen the film. I just had to rehash my notes from Blue Jasmine.
It is a romantic comedy where actually you're rooting for the two protagonists to not end up together, and that's not a good position to be in.
Okay, yeah, that's a very good analysis.
Okay, well, Magic and the Moonlight goes on general UK release on September the 19th, I believe. Okay, the Wedge-like programme for the Cambridge Film Festival can always be a little daunting to tackle, but it's worth persevering with. Many of the most interesting screenings are of the rare and the beautiful, for instance, the micro cinema strand this year, which is full of 1950s American avant-garde and which is wonderful, is sort of buried at the back of the booklet, so you have to go looking. But usually the most another thing you have to keep an eye out for is the short fusions, over 30 films from all around the world, sort of bonsai cinema, sequenced into five themed strands. To get a lowdown on this year's short fusion films, I spoke to Sarah McIntosh, an occasional reviewer for this programme, but much more importantly, the person in charge of how the festival presents and frames its short films. I asked Sarah for her thoughts on the current state of short film production, which always seems to be in rude health, but first I inquired about how the fusion's five strands had come together.
This year I wanted to try something a little bit different. I'd had a few films in and seen a few films that kind of looked like they almost might be natural pairings, either similar themes or similar moods. So I thought it might be quite interesting to have slightly shorter strands that relate to each other. And then, you know, if you see one strand, you get to go and see the other. That was the sort of the inspiration behind the twins theme. But then I think the other themes this year are fairly similar to themes I had last year, probably showing my own bias. It tends to be themes, I think, that are quite universal. So this year we've got one called Beloved. We've got one this year called Connection. So that could almost relate to the existential theme that we had last year. And then Life Lessons, big life questions, and fitting them into those. That was kind of the main inspiration for them.
So if you go to see a feature film at the festival, knowing there's no trailers and there's no adverts in front, you go in there for an hour and a half, 2 hours usually. How long do the short programmes last?
Obviously, you know, you want to give people value for money, so you don't want it to be too short. Hence why, you know, I think when we're offering the 60 minute shorts programs, that there's some incentive that they then get to go and see this other 60 minutes for free. But with the other strands, the non twin strands, I tend to work sort of about 80 to 90 minutes, so you have about, that seems to be about a good level for attention spans, and try and do that. Some might be very slightly over by 5 or 6 minutes, but it's all about trying to squidge in as much as possible.
How long can a short film be before it becomes something else entirely?
Well, the way our categories work, the longest that a short film can be is 30 minutes. That's our cutoff.
How long does this all take to pull together?
The submissions tend to open around January, February, and then it takes us almost until festival time to get the programme together. A wonderful reviewing team go through and watch every short film, documentary and feature that's submitted. As well as the submissions, there are a limited amount of films that are short films that are invited into the festival as well. But our main bulk of films comes from those filmmakers that have submitted to us.
Have you got favourites amongst the screenings? Or is it like choosing a favourite of all your children?
How dare you?
Or all your 30-plus children, which is your favourite?
I can't make decisions like that. It's really strange how protective I become of every film that's got into the festival. All these films I absolutely love. I mean, there are obvious ones that stand out because Petit Frère was shown in Cannes, so that stands out for that. And you've a film called The Showreel, which is from Keir Burrows. That stands out because he's a returning filmmaker. We've had him in some of his films in the festival before. Cowboy Ben, you know, when you start getting people like Sean Dooley and Ramon Tikaram in films, you know, that then that they stand out for that as well.
People might not be aware of how rich and how varied and how high quality short films have become. Well, they're not some sort of distant, embarrassing relation to feature films. They are an art form in and of themselves.
Well, there's you'd be very surprised, and in fact, I was the first time that I went to a short screening. It's just the quality and the production values that go into them. There's a real artistry to it, and there seems to be a sort of temporal prejudice against short films that somehow they're a lesser art form than a feature film. Whereas, in much the same way as short story writing, you're putting all that emotion, all those that roller coaster of feelings and relationships that people make with the characters in a feature film, and then condensing that down into, I mean, sometimes only six or seven minutes. To be able to do that, to be able to take someone on an emotional journey in that amount of short amount of time, and for it to not look like a trailer for a feature film, or for it to not look just kind of fizzle out near the end, that takes a lot of skill.
Cambridge 105.
Community radio in your city.
Many, many thanks to Sarah McIntosh for sitting down for the interview, which was done the day before the hurly-burly of the festival swallowed her entirely. You can find out all about the Short Fusion seasons and the five and the way they've been themed by turning to page 70 of the Cambridge Film Festival programme. And you can catch the next batch of shorts this coming Tuesday at 11 a.m. and then a different series of shorts at 8 p.m. Whilst movies have always been quick to illustrate the tempestuous moods of the male teenager, they're slightly more squeamish when it comes to girls, which makes the award-winning I Believe in Unicorns, directed by Lea Meyerhoff, as an unapologetic... She's directed it as an unapologetic headlong... I can say these words except on air. Headlong rush into the mind of a girl caught halfway between fairy tales and sexual desire, all the more welcome and refreshing. The film stars Natalia Dyer as Davina, a teenager whose daily life is focused on looking after her wheelchair-bound mother. She allows herself to escape to an imaginary world of fireworks, forests and unicorns. Her attentions then focus on Sterling, a leather-jacketed schoolyard rocker and skateboarder, too laconic for words and dangerously a few years older than her. Eager for escape, Davina convinces Sterling to take her on a road trip across the prairie. But is this his first relationship true love or just a summer fling? Ed, I Believe in Unicorns, which is yet screened at the festival, it's treading familiar ground in terms of it's a bit like Badlands in terms of the narration and a younger girl falling for a slightly more dangerous older teenager. That's exalted company, and I'm sure it doesn't try to measure up to that, but is it too much sketchbook cinema? Because it dances around visually. Does it really get into the mind of Natalia's character?
I think that it does. In the it does a lot to try and find that innocent, deluded headspace. I just think its particular characterization of that headset space is a little bit basic and unsubtle. I think what they're doing is interesting. I think how they did it is problematic. And that's not to say there aren't good points to it. I think there's a really good soundtrack that's sort of slightly lilted, slightly off-key, which makes you feel this sort of unease from very early on. I think the casting of the main actress is absolutely perfect. She is sort of the platonic form of kind of a slightly deluded, very, very innocent young girl. She just, when you see her, she just looks perfect. And there are little bits of kind of interesting subtlety. There are some Badland references in there. For me, I was just massively, massively put off by the lack of the heavy-handed sort of conveyance of its ideas, the complete lack of subtlety that, of course, of course, she's believes in unicorns and these sort of completely ridiculous magic
things.
Well,
she doesn't believe in them.
Well, not believe in them, but she has these sort of fantasies which are so, so immature. It's so over the top. Of course, at home she has a disabled mum who she wants to escape from. Of course, the male figure has had an abusive past. It all seems a bit too cliche to me. And it kind of ruined what could have been a really interesting and really subtle film if they just dumbed it down a little bit. Not dumbed it down, dimmed it down a little bit. Sort of kept her just as slightly more normal and kept everyone in it slightly more normal, rather than having these real extremes, these real cliches, which for me just tore it away from something that could have been much more insightful and much more interesting.
Mark, Ed's got a point. It's stylistically, which features stop motion animation and all sorts of dream sequences that she's having. Then she incorporates Sterling into her dangerous boyfriend. But I was actually put off by these things whilst watching it. And it took me a couple of times to get through a few of the scenes because they were so, not cloying, but so dangerously near mawkish. But after the film was over, I found it had a sort of resonance of power I wasn't expecting. How did you...
I would agree with that. I was a little worried that it did feel a little twee and student-y when it first started. But actually, probably while I was watching the film rather than after it, that it started to have that cumulative effect for me. I thought actually the combination of the dream sequence, the sort of fantasy sequences, the stop motion, which I think were done in 16mm and had a very nice effect. They weren't overdone. They never outstayed their welcome in individual moments. And actually, they started to then complement the story really well. I mean, it's nothing revolutionary. I would agree that it's not subtle. But actually, as an overall
is
effect...
Is it really revolutionary? Because we keep mentioning Badlands, which is 40 years old. There aren't very many films that give us... And this is a female director. I'm not aware of her age, but she's obviously young. She's come up through film school. This is produced by Alison Anders, who made Cast Food Lodging and Grace of the Heart. And this is an unusual perspective to get in a film. You see a little bit more of this sort of stuff at festivals, perhaps. But I felt as a view of a girl who's just coming into some sort of sexual awareness that the mix between that, because it's quite a carnal film. And this fairy tale stuff. I thought that really we hadn't seen that before. I thought that was refreshing. I wish we'd had Sarah see it just because it was an unusual. Because all women think the same, and any women. I'm dangerously near to sounding reductive there. But it needed another point of view, I felt. And I thought that was unusual and very refreshing.
I would agree. You know, it's only 70 minutes once you knock the fairly lengthy credits off, so it doesn't outstay its welcome by any means. It's of a very much of a form. There's not a massive story structure to it. It's just almost like a sort of well put together mood piece in that sense. It is the kind of film that you'll often only get the chance to see at festivals, but I would say it's one worth catching.
Ed, is it in the end too sketchbooky for you? I sort of made that reference earlier on, but I liked the dream sequences, but I felt it leapt a little bit too much. It was like one of those pop videos in the 1980s where they suddenly started to throw everything in, and there were too many techniques. If it had stayed with stop motion and the model work that it had for the unicorns and for the dragons, which sort of comes to represent Sterling, then I would have been happy with that. Or if it stayed with a different technique, but it keeps throwing things in, and I felt that was a little bit inconsistent.
Yeah, I wasn't a massive fan of all the kind of stop motion. I think the beginning bit with the sort of old camera sequence in the beginning credits is very good, but the rest of the sort of additions that kind of are meant to be escapism into her mind were a bit... I'm trying to find the right word. They kind of clashed a little bit. Apart from... and there was a bit... There were too many variations of it as well.
Yes,
there was
stop
motion, and then there was also her sort of wandering around in her white dress and kind of dressed as a bird.
It was different points of view. Yeah. I think that's what the problem I have, and that what made me think of a sketchbook cinema, which is something I've leveled at something like Sucker Punch, but I think it's equally pertinent here. Is that the stop motion is her point of view? That's what's inside her head. But when we go to her in a white dress or walking along
the
beach,
is that someone else's point of view?
It's still her point of view, but the technique takes us out of her mind. It seems to be we're watching her in this environment rather than watching what she sees, and I found that inconsistent and a little bit ill thought out.
Yeah, I mean, I personally could have done without it. I very very happily would have seen this film if it was effectively had none of the sort of additional stop motion into her mind bits, didn't have all the sort of cliches, if it was literally just deluded innocent girl falls in love with someone who maybe she shouldn't and they go on a road trip and there's that element of discovery. I would have been perfectly happy with that if they kept the mood and the tone, but I felt like it was trying to do too much and doing it in a fairly
because it's the mind of a teenage girl, the imagery can be a bit, it is hackneyed. Her Sterling, who's this violent boyfriend who becomes increasingly violent through the film, is portrayed as a sort of sock puppet dragon that eventually takes on this unicorn. I thought, when it stayed within the stop motion, I thought that juxtaposed with the sort of stripped-down, bare aesthetics of the rest of the film, especially the sex scenes, was remarkable. I thought that was quite brilliant. But when it started to stray into other dream sequences and other techniques, then it began to borrow a term that Mark used before we came on air. It began to resemble an advert a little bit.
I would just try and present the voice of dissension on this one. I actually think that the differences in the different sequences, for me, effectively showed the opening up in her own mind as she's developing that slightly more self-awareness as she's going through the experience with Sterling, where actually it's a very sort of narrow focus view where she has these similar fantasies to start with, and actually they then start to develop different characters as her feelings, her emotions are starting to evolve. That's what I took from it, and consequently I think I enjoyed it slightly more than both of you did as a consequence. So for me it worked.
That's true, but perhaps I was slightly... I had to watch, because I saw a screener, I had to watch it in several sections, so perhaps I did.
Well, I saw it on an iPhone, so I can't say.
Good grief. Crikey.
Yes.
The future's with us.
Sorry, 2 inches away from my face on an iPhone, but in that small context, it worked very well. But do take the chance to see it on a cinema screen if you can.
Yes, okay. Well, we'll wrap up on that. I Believe in Unicorns has two festival screenings coming up. The first is this very afternoon at 4 p.m, so in about 3.5 hours. And that is followed by a special live Skype conversation with the main actress in it, Natalia Dyer. I think we're all in agreement that she's very, very good. Mm. And was the supporting her best friend? Was that the actress from Electric Children, which I know you've seen?
And she's also in Sin City 2, which is out at the minute.
Oh,
as well.
That's.
And it was also Amy Simetz in a brief role as a teacher from Upstream Colour and The Killing. So,
crikey.
So she's got some good names.
And you saw it on an iPhone.
I did.
Where everybody was tiny, like postage stamp faces, and you still recognise them.
I did.
Anyway, and there's a second screening. So there's a Skype Q&A after the screening today, after the 4 o'clock screening today, and there's a second screening tomorrow, Sunday the 31st, at 6:15.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
You are indeed listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me in the studio this afternoon are Sir Dylan, Ed Elliott and Mark Livesich. And this is the first of our two specials dedicated to the ongoing 34th Cambridge Film Festival. Still to come on Cambridge 105 today, between following on after us and going on till 2 o'clock, is Bookmark. From 2 till 4 is Best of the Guests. They're still sort of recovering from the end of summer Saturday. From 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock is 105 Sport, which as usual follows all the live action, all the local action from Cambridge United, Cambridge City and Histon FC, plus scorelines from the Premier League, the Football Conference, and I would imagine the ongoing one-day international with India. After that is between 6 and 7 is Jason Allen, followed at, and then we sort of get into the specialist music programmes. From 7 to 8 is Club Global, and from 8 to midnight, the Party Zone with Matt Webb, which is 4 hours of floor fillers and dance classics. That's still all to come. We've still got a whole bundle of reviews and an article on the film The White City, but first we're plotting the downfall of Western civilization.
In 2048, the oceans are going to be empty. How deep is this anyway?
200 feet. God knows that dam wants to come down.
We all should know what we're dealing with
here. Can you please shut up?
People are talking.
Who's talking? Well, you don't think she would do anything stupid?
I don't know. That's why I'm calling you.
What are you going to do?
What do you mean?
I mean, are you going to do anything? One person. That's all it takes.
You said no one would get hurt.
American director Kelly Reichardt is spinning an increasingly important body of work from the fringes of American cinema. Her last film, Meek's Cutoff, fascinatingly wandered around the edge of the conventional Western, whilst her new release, Night Moves, which has been screening at the festival, has all the suspenseful trappings of a Hollywood thriller. But Reichardt is once again more interested in characters and explosions and in the repercussion of aggression rather than the act itself. Jesse Eisenberg plays Joss, an environmental activist sent to sail a boat packed with explosives into the side of a dam. He hopes the resulting chaos will be a major eco-statement that will stop America sleepwalking into disaster. A fervent believer in the cause, Joss is suspicious of his companion Denna, played by Dakota Fanning, who's managed to wrangle a place on the mission by paying for the boat with her trust fund money. But both are uncomfortable with a third member of this ragtag team, Peter Sarsgaard's ex-marine, brought on board to find and prime the explosives. Mark, this has, as I said, all the markings of a thriller. And if you go through the IMDb user reviews, which I tend to do just before an air, just to see if it sparks any ideas, they all hate it because it didn't deliver on the thrills front. But I found it 2 hours of consistently threatening and tension-filled cinema.
And you're not alone in that. I was gripped from beginning to end. I think in terms of the casting, the performances work really well. I'll take an example, Peter Sarsgaard, who in so many films turns up and just feels disinterested. Actually here, he feels disinterested, but that's exactly the point, and it works really well. And the fact that then you suddenly see these things going on, like he happens to know someone near the dam where they're plotting to do their act, and he's very casual about it, actually then just builds further and further into the tension. And by the time they're actually then trying to commit these acts, there's this whole scene in the middle of the film where I was practically chewing off my fingernails. It was absolutely riveting. I was a big fan of Meek's Cut Off, as the only other Kelly Reichardt film I've seen, but on the evidence of these two, I'd be seeking out more. I think she seems to have a real gift for being able to take these quiet situations and spin them into something deeply interesting. It's a trio of really good central performances. It's an interesting script. It doesn't always go where you'd expect. It's riveting from start to finish.
It's filled with fascinating themes and ideas that it sort of, because you watch it as a basic thriller, and if you're going expecting a sort of James Bond type thriller or a sort of traditional Hollywood thriller, yes, it will be disappointing. It doesn't do that, but as an art film, perhaps it's particularly thriller-esque. But the idea she manages, her and her scriptwriter John Raymond manage to spin out of it, is the things it has to say about the woolly-minded aggression of terrorists, whether they're homegrown or domestic terrorists, or whether they're Islamic militants or any form of militant, is fascinating. I thought that was very well observed. And
there's a great shorthand going on throughout the film. There's so many different comments on things like that, on things like the consequence of the catastrophe that these things have had on the environment, and they're often just dropped in as background to a scene, or they're not referenced. The scene sort of passes through them. You really have to be giving it your full attention, otherwise you will miss a lot of the nuances of the film. But it's just superbly well constructed from start to finish, and you get exactly the right amount you need to. I can remember when I saw Meek's Cut Off at the Arts Picture House, there was this massive consternation at the end where people actually sat in their seats screaming, is that it? They couldn't cope with this, the European concept that she has of not necessarily getting to the end. And you sometimes get that with individual scenes in the film, but actually you get just enough information.
The story this film is telling,
yes,
and it's the same with Meek's Cut Off, does come to an end. It's just, it's not telling the story people think it's telling.
Yes. Somebody actually made I can't remember who it was, somebody at the Picture House made the observation to me yesterday as well, apologies to whoever it was, that had this great insight, that actually almost every scene is plot-driven. There's very little, although there's a huge amount that's actually contextual in terms of the environment and setting the scene, almost every moment is constructed to move the narrative forward and does so very effectively.
It's almost a procedural. You can put it alongside something like Zodiac or Manhunter in terms of watching an operation come together, and that's and one of the side effects of that is that up until, I think, around about two-thirds of the way through the film, you're sort of on their side. It plays with your sympathy. Certainly the brilliant scene where Dakota Fanning goes to buy the fertilizer, you're with her every step of the way. Mm. And she's not written. The others in the team seem to think she's this weak woman who's going to let them down. She's not. She's more capable than they are in many regards. Mm. And they just are never there to see it. But you want her to succeed. You don't want her to... You do want her to succeed. You don't want them to... Possibly, maybe, because the film is having its cake and eating a little bit. In fact, they're not violent. They don't want to be violent. They don't plan this explosion to cause death, just destruction. But I found that fascinating, the way you kept switching sides. And as you say, I thought the film was brilliantly cast. And Jesse Eisenberg is always interesting because he doesn't care if he's disliked. In any film I've ever seen him in, he's not afraid of playing a complete jerk.
Mm.
And
yeah, I mean, he's very well cast in this as well, because he's got that laid back. You know, he's very good in the sort of darkly comic films. He was very frustrated in The Double earlier this year, and that I think he was very good in. And here, there's a lot of sort of gently darkly comic scenes sort of scattered throughout. Actually, one of my favourites wasn't him. It was when they've sort of set the bomb, and then Peter Sarsgaard goes back to it to see if it could possibly disarm it, just sort of looking at it blankly going, I didn't actually think this through before I did it. It was just brilliant.
I'd forgotten about that. They leave him for some time staring at the wiring, and you think he's doing something because that's his job, he's an ex-marine, and then when they go back to it, he's still staring at the wiring. I'd forgotten about that. Yes, that was quite one of many, many brilliant touches.
But it's also brilliant in the sense that there's a ticking clock going on the whole time, and actually it's just building the tension.
Did you think, as a last point, without revealing the end, obviously the bomb goes off and there's repercussions from this explosion, from the chaos they deliberately wrought, but that the way the characters move from there, from the sort of the guilt that they had, do you think that, because I thought maybe there was a little bit of imbalance in the script, and I wasn't quite convinced by the turn that Josh took, because suddenly her narrative, her use of her point of view has to change, to go back to how we were talking about Unicorn. Suddenly you're focused a lot more on his character, and I didn't feel he was entirely always believable in his motivations.
I think it's a little difficult. There are only so many ways that plot could go at that point. And I think ultimately it probably chose the most believable route in the context of the film. You know, it is very much grounded in reality, even through what it's trying to achieve. You know, I think if it's trying to be true to the characters ultimately. Maybe the ending was a little over the top. It almost had a sort of...
I like the very, very ending. I thought that was tremendously wonderful in its weak, deliberate weakness.
Yes, the last couple of scenes are brilliant. The bit slightly before that, without spoiling too much, had a sort of Grand Guignol feel to it, which did feel slightly out of place with what had gone before. But yeah, there's a whole host of wonderful little moments scattered throughout the film. I can't recommend it highly enough.
Well, Night Moves has enjoyed its two screenings of the Cambridge Film Festival. The reason we're reviewing it now is it is on general release. It is a Certificate 15. Enjoying a screening this very afternoon, the Saturday afternoon at the Cambridge Film Festival, is The White City, a fascinating and ever so slightly controversial drama from writer Tanner King Barclow and director Gil Kaufman. The White City stars Thomas Dekker and Hayley Bennett as friends who casually flutter in and out of being lovers. Both artists, she's a writer whilst he's an avant-garde filmmaker of some description, they take a break in the bohemian quarter of Tel Aviv for inspiration and a change of scene. But inspiration is tricky. They're both distracted by parties and strangers, though not noticeably by the tensions of the region. In fact, they're blissfully, almost offensively, ignorant of the politics. They even plan a day trip to Gaza to sightsee on the Palestinians. Just before the White City's first screening at the film festival, so this was yesterday, I spoke to Gil Kaufman about the complicated reactions his film is bound to have, reactions that people perhaps weren't intended when he was making it. But I began by asking how he and Tanner King Barclow, his co-writer, had conceived of this slow-motion drama.
We were trying to make a film that was anti-plot. Originally, we had the idea, we were walking in Berlin, and we said, why don't we do something about, you know, hipsters in Berlin, because there's a, you know, big population of young kids going there now. And as we voted for Berlin, we decided it'd be more interesting if we could, in some way, have a backdrop that was political, that they could ignore, or in a country that was even much more of a hotbed, something that was still alive and you know, volcanically, not so dormant. So we said, what if we had this American couple come to Tel Aviv and they're completely oblivious? And so the story, back to your question, to loop back around, is we try to focus on the substrate of this world of the loneliness of these characters against a backdrop that was, you know, very much, you know, kind of in relief against this, you know, political hotbed, without ever alluding to it or making it, italicizing it in a very kind of, you know, foreground way.
Once you decided to move the story to Tel Aviv, how did that change the script? Because obviously it's a much more difficult situation to represent it at the best of times.
I'd been there before. And I actually speak Hebrew, so for me, but I haven't been there in 20 years. We met a bunch of people, we interviewed people, then we noticed stuff that was going on. And this was a much quieter period than what is going on now, obviously. It was more kind of internecine and kind of it was more about the politics of the country at the moment in terms of economics. So it wasn't what's happening now, which is overtly, you know, a conflagration. It was more kind of a much quieter, muted dissatisfaction amongst the population. So all of that is in the background without really being talked about. I think the strength of the film is, again, not the story, but the characters and the fact that you see chemistry really developing in very subtle repetitions and gestures and stuff, the way it would in your life.
When I was watching it, I wasn't aware how much I was supposed to dislike these ugly Americans that had... You've got a situation where you expect to see something of the culture, and you do, but they're almost oddly disinclined to learn anything, disinclined to engage.
You, absolutely. I mean, it's a totally solipsistic and hermetic view of the world, you know, and when he engages, like you said, with the camera, or even when he's with the kids at the beginning, it's all about his needs and kind of this totally selfish pursuit. We wanted to see how far we could push that, and that's part of the film. Again, does it work or not? I think I can't tell. For me, I kind of am enamored with the fact that we tried it, so I'm not the right person to ask. But whether an audience would embrace that, I don't know.
How has the current situation played with, not with the reception of the film, but how you think the film will be read?
I don't know. I think I'm very on pins and needles about that, just because tomorrow, actually, when it's shown, will be the premiere of the film with a real audience. So we'll see. And it's right on the, you know, kind of the culmination of what's happening now with Israel and Gaza. In terms of how it'll be remembered in history, I think, you know, these things come in waves in terms of movies and the politics. And unless you're addressing the politics directly in your film, it'll age and, you know, it won't matter. But if it's real, you know, like Shakespeare would have all the ballads, not about the ballads.
But aren't you worried about it concentrating your character? Because it's not just them. It's there's the same blasé approach from both the Israelis and the Palestinians here in the film. And they go to Gaza almost as a theme park,
right,
which I
absolutely
know is perfectly true, but it seems... it was remarkable then. We were just didn't have the perspective to see how remarkable it was.
Right. Yeah, no, you're right. Even Tafiq, who goes, he's very blasé about it. They say, well, we go... And when we asked him when we were shooting, I said, have you gone? He goes, yeah, we can go to Gaza if you want. You just go. I go, yeah. And it's written like that in the script, but that dialogue was written based on what he told us. We hadn't imposed our conceit or whatever on that. That was really kind of literally taken off from a page from his book where he was telling us, you guys want to go? We'll go. There's no... And at that time, you could. I mean, it doesn't mean that things were good. Obviously, they were building tunnels and things were going on and rallying and, you know, shipments weren't going in of food. I mean, so, but it was still delusional in some respect. But I don't know. I think your question is really interesting in terms of like 5 years from now, you know, depending where the politics are, how this film will be, you know, absorbed.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many thanks to Gil Kaufman for sitting down to the interview. Unbelievably courteous and intelligent after very little sleep after a transatlantic flight. And a big thank to Rosie Hunt from Take One for helping to arrange the interview. The White City has another festival screening tomorrow. So is it tomorrow, August the 31st at 1:30 in the afternoon. That's right, sorry. Got confused with all my dates. So tomorrow, 1:30 in the afternoon. After producing two of the most sumptuous animations of the past few years, the lunatic cycling and gangster drama that is Bellevue Rendezvous and the Jacques Tati love letter of The Illusionist, French filmmaker Sylvain Chamet has made a leap to live action with the much anticipated Attila Marcel, a magical mystery tour set in present-day France. The film is scheduled to play the Cambridge Film Festival tomorrow. Paul is a milquetoast buttered on both sides by the suffocating love of his two frightful aunts. Now aged 33, Paul hasn't spoken a word since the mysterious death of his parents, an event which seems to have triggered a desire to be a concert pianist. But then into his life steps the mysterious Madame Proust, a neighbour who plays the ukulele, walks a bear-like dog, grows a vast kitchen garden in her flat, and has a penchant for strong herbal tea. This tea, she confesses to Paul, is so strong it could help revive lost memories of his parents. Sarah, to start with you, it's always fascinating to see how an animator fares when they turn their hand and eye to live action. How has Chamet managed with Attila Marcel?
I thought it was a lovely film. It's in the same mode, French film mode, as kind of Amelie. It's slightly whimsical, slightly romantic, elements of the surreal and the real. I think what I really liked about it, and it'd be interesting to see how many viewers pick up on this, is that it's also a clever film. I mean, Madame Proust is obviously the reference to Proust. When they have the tea that helps them fish for memories, they have a Madeleine afterwards, and the Madeleine was the prime example in Proust's Remembrance of Lost Time of the moment in which you have involuntary memories, the memory that comes back to you, usually triggered by smell or taste or sound or music, as in the film. But it's also a very clever film about psychoanalysis, and that was what was lovely as well. This is what you're seeing, is the process of someone doing exactly what psychoanalytic therapy is supposed to do. It's to draw up your memories that are causing some kind of blockage here, the inability to speak, and to purge them, to get rid of them, in order that you can then move on. And that's not a very dramatic, romantic, or exciting process normally, if you're just lying on the psychoanalytic couch. So somehow he's managed to make this beautiful film about therapy. And all of it done, yes, without his trademark animation. I think it could have been animated, and there are animated moments, the slightly bizarre and wonderful singing frogs.
Which, I don't think they're animated. I think they're people in costumes.
Oh, people in costumes. I beg your pardon. Yeah, but it recalls the idea of animation, of cartoon. But I don't think it doesn't work as a live action.
I felt, Ed, that the big holdover from animation and from his previous films is the change in tone. Is in that there's quite some. I mean, the film addresses spousal abuse and then goes a different direction with it, which I think some people might find a bit awkward in a live action environment, but would pass muster in an animated format. In if it was animated, there's all sorts of those changes with tone. Cancer is dealt with in various ways, and there's environmental issues. There's all sorts of things, and it keeps moving from one to the other, skipping from one to the other. Did you find that worked, or was that something that really should have been kept in animation? In live action, it felt a little bit lead-footed.
No, I think it worked incredibly well. In fact, I think that one of the really masterful elements of this film is that, in fact, it does maintain a fairly animated, I would say, almost cartoony aspect to the film.
But in the real world, this isn't
yeah,
Amelie's
exactly. But,
fairy tale,
I mean,
world.
It's kind of amazing. I don't want to say Wes Anderson, because Wes Anderson is doing a completely different thing, but it has that sort of reality, but lilted to the point where it doesn't seem real. In everything apart from the main characters, and I think that's a really important point, that both Paul and Madame Proust are kind of the only real thinking people in there. So everything, it deals with these issues in a way that, again, has its cake and eats it. It's both...
Has its real, Madeleine and eats
has
it.
Has its Madeleine. Oh, I missed the chance. Oh, dear.
and goodbye.
That's all, folks. Yeah, so it manages to deal with all these difficult issues in that sort of light-hearted way that cartoons can, but also gives it a sense of gravitas, because the main characters, the ones that you're emotionally attached to, feel real. They feel like characters, and you can see their emotions and feel their emotions in the way that they do. And in that way, I think it's incredibly both, I wouldn't say, well, powerful is possibly the wrong word, but it's incredibly moving and also very light-hearted.
I found sections of it moving. I found Madame Proust's fate. I found that the very last scene with her, when he goes to the visit, visits her, I found certain things that he found there very moving. I found sections of that. I found little details, which again seemed like a holdover from animation. The final scene, almost the final scene, with the broken angel that's been split in the two, from the side of the piano. Things like that I found quite marvellous. And it's sort of a last point. Do you think it's So it's not stretched out at all. No, I think it's a supporting character. I think that's the thing I got the most... That was what I meant to ask. He's actually, like Triplets Belleville, our hero is quite dull.
Well,
I mean,
he can't speak.
He can't speak, so he...
Yes.
But to be fair, but again, like, neither does the cyclist in Triplets Belleville. But the supporting characters... I love the ants who get drunk on glazed cherries and wander off down
Brandy
the beach.
Cherries.
Brandy
yes,
cherries.
And the beautiful scene where he's playing this amazing classical piece of music and they're just spitting the cherries out, and you get the rhythm of the spitting.
And that's another animation thing. The sound work is tremendous.
But that's, I mean, it is a film that, like animation, it's very much about objects. There's lots of really important objects in this film. It's kind of a nice way to contrast it to the Woody Allen that we opened with. This is a film that tells its story through images. It has to, because its main character doesn't speak, and that's an absolute contrast to the Woody Allen, which tries to tell it through words, and I loved Attila Marcel for
yeah.
that.
Yeah, interestingly, both Attila Marcel and Magic in the Moonlight have ukuleles as very prominent
yes,
plot points.
Yes, I was thinking, is this a ukulele,
the
ukulele theme?
I thought this show had got me on purely because of the
I thought that was
references.
The only thing I didn't like about Attila Marcel was the, or annoyed me slightly, was the ukulele score. I know Madame Proust plays a ukulele, but I thought that was a little bit too far towards a whimsy that I'd heard rather than seen far too many times. I thought that was too easy a step.
Except for the lovely moment at the end, which I won't ruin, but where the ukulele comes into its element.
When it becomes suddenly sentient, yes. That is wonderful. But I have a feeling he just had a ukulele in the film for that moment.
Possibly.
Otherwise, I'm not quite sure it worked, and it was a bit too, a little bit too obvious. But anyway, well worth seeing.
Absolutely.
Oh, definitely.
I presume it's not, it has, I don't think, believe it's got a UK distribution deal yet, but.
Well,
if it does, I'm sure.
A chance to watch it now.
Yes. Yes. So Attila Marcel only has one screening at the Cambridge Film Festival, which is tomorrow, Sunday the 31st at 6:30 in the early evening. It is a Certificate 15. This is a fairy tale with the F word. And that is all we have time for on our first Cambridge Film Festival special. We'll be back with our second special in a week's time at 12 p.m. on Saturday the 6th with another bundle of reviews and interviews and previews. And don't forget that we've got a daily podcast planned for every weekday on Cambridge 105, broadcasting once about 4:30 in the afternoon on Julian Clover's Drive show, and then again after 9 a.m. on the 105 Breakfast Show with Lee and Merlin. The idea behind these podcasts is to draw attention to an overlooked gem of the festival, something that may be residing in the back of the brochure or something in the seasons that hasn't, you know, that really shouldn't be missed and may not come again. We'll play out with some Fela Kuti, the great innovator of Afrobeat, who is the subject of the documentary Finding Fela, screening at the Cambridge Film Festival later next week. Please stay tuned for Bookmark, but from everybody on Bums on Seats, goodbye.
Ah, I beg, let us get down into another on-the-ground spiritual game. I beg. After my paso-paso, you go to help me end down with mwah, because them go here mwah. Yeah. Ah, oh. Hey. Ah, paso, 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 paso. Oh, ah, yeah, 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 oh, yeah, ah, when the one to call, yeah, when the one to call, yeah, when the one to call, Nigerian government, them GMM, federal military government,
federal military government,
for Libya, them GMM, Liberation Council,
Liberation Council,
for Liberia, them giam name, Redemptional Council,
Redemptional Council.
For Zion, them giam name, Revolutionary Council,
Revolutionary Council.
Them get different names for different governments, but the correct name for them now, soldier go, soldier come,
soldier go, soldier come,
soldier go, soldier come,
soldier go, soldier come.
Federal military government, Libya Liberation Council,
Soldado, Soldado.
Liberia Redemption.